Looking for a Thinking Persons podcast? Go no further. The Green Planet Monitor is a weekly package of interviews and stories about global ecology, human development, social justice, and progressive science. Check out the GPM at greenplanetmonitor.net. Welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, July 21st, 2023. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, national politics reporter Stephen Wentzel sits down with Lida McCullough-Seletsky, author of The Kneeling Man, My Father's Life as a Black Spy Who Witnessed the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. Lida McCullough-Seletsky grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, and now lives in Walnut Creek, California. A litigator turned essayist and memoirist, her work has appeared in The Atlantic, The New York Times, O, The Oprah Magazine, The Washington Post, and elsewhere. Her essay, The Man in the Picture, published in O, The Oprah Magazine, was selected as a notable essay in Best American Essays 2019. The Kneeling Man tells the life story of Seletsky's father and his witnessing of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. Here are McCullough-Seletsky and Wentzel in conversation. Take a listen.
All right, so Lida, I guess to get started, the book came out last month. What has the response been like, and how do you feel about the reception to the book?
So the response has been tremendous. I've been bowled over. I mean, you know, how people would respond, how readers would respond was really something that I wondered about. Not that I wrote the book kind of anticipating a certain response, but I really just didn't know. And I have been so blown away by how readers have connected with this story. I have heard from people literally all around the globe telling me how much the story meant to them, how it spoke to them, how they could relate to the themes and the narrative. I have talked to not just individual readers, but various journalists and people like that. And so it's just been a really beautiful response.
So take me back to the beginning. When did you decide, okay, I want to write a book about my dad?
Yeah, so I made that decision really at the same time that I decided I wanted to know his story. I mean, those decisions kind of went hand in hand, which looking back now, I think, you know, on one hand, how terribly naive, you know, because I didn't know what the story was. And I mean, I'd been afraid of what I might potentially find out in delving into dad's story. But on the other hand, I recognized from the beginning that whatever dad's story was, it was something that needed to be documented and something that was bigger than just our family, but that was also a puzzle piece of history that we had a responsibility to preserve and to share.
So walk me through kind of the logistics and like the challenges of you know, actually like putting all those tens of thousands of words on paper.
Yes, the logistics. I would say logistically, quite challenging in many ways because, well, first of all, I had never written any kind of creative nonfiction at all. And so just from a craft perspective, understanding how to do that required me to educate myself. I had to take a creative nonfiction writing course, which I did in 2015, and just, you know, reading craft books. And then, of course, just being a reader of other people's work. I mean, you know, good readers make good writers, as they say. So just getting up to speed and understanding the craft side of telling a nonfiction story. Then there was the question of how to assemble the facts. And so, you know, coming from a litigation background, I practiced law for roughly 7 years. I did have some understanding of how to gather facts and assess them and how to do research. And so my most important resource was my dad and just getting his first person account of things. And that really was the priority because I thought, you know, there is a huge universe out there potentially of resources about the sanitation strike, which is the context of Dr. King's coming to Memphis and ultimately being assassinated. But, you know, there's so much out there about that, about Dr. King himself, about the civil rights movement, about Black militant movements such as the Invaders, which was the Black militant group that my dad infiltrated as a police officer. So anyway, I knew that there was a lot out there, a huge amount. It was very intimidating. But my father is the best source. And, you know, he's not going to be around forever. And so that's where I need to start. And so I immediately started documenting his story. And he actually kind of helped me along by initially drafting up 17 pages of notes, which were essentially a thumbnail sketch of his entire life from birth in Tibbs, Mississippi in 1944 through, you know, his present life. And so, you know, he had documented that much, but of course there was so much, that wasn't, you know, that wouldn't fit in those notes. And I had so many questions about what was in those notes. And so I began interviewing him and we started face to face in 2015. We met at my brother's house, which was in the Atlanta suburbs. And that began a process of interviews that were recorded and transcribed. And so at the end of that process, which didn't end until January of last year or so, so from 2015 to 2022, I ended up with 5 very large volumes of interview transcripts with him that became primary sources that, you know, those don't exist anywhere else. So I did that. I also ended up having to submit FOIA requests to get FBI and Memphis police documents. And so that was its own logistical process. I had never done a FOIA request before, Freedom of Information Act. And so I had to figure out how to do that, get the request in, you know, which I initially had submitted to the FBI. And it turned out they had transferred the documents to the National Archives. And so I ended up having to go through that whole process. I had to fight because it was a collaborative process in many ways. And the National Archives folks are consummate professionals and they're great at what they do. But there was a little bit of a dispute about whether I should get expedited production of the document. So I had to go research the federal regulations, appeal their decision not to expedite their production, which I won. But, you know, that's just another whole logistical front of telling this story. And then, of course, finding the time to write, because I am a mom of 3 sons right now. I had 2 when I first started writing the book. And when I began the book, which was in 2015, is when I actually started writing. So there was a 5-year lapse between having the idea and proposing it and actually working on the book. But when I first started, I was, for all practical purposes, I was a single mom because my husband was living overseas and, you know, working overseas. And so I'm living in the High Sierra in the Lake Tahoe region with these 2 boys. I'm brand new there. And I've got to run this household, get sort of acclimated to this environment, and then write this book. So that part, I would say, was probably the most challenging. Just finding the time to do it And having the faith to tell myself that even though, you know, 15 minutes here, an hour there doesn't feel like enough to write a book, having that faith to know that it actually does add up day after day. And even if you get 500 words down a day, I mean, at the end of a month, you have, you know, quite a few words. And so just being relentless about that part of the process, in the sense that, you know, I had to remain consistent and day after day, you know, putting some words down on the page and putting together all this research and all these interviews and getting that down in a cohesive narrative. So that's really the creative process and the logistics of that.
I'm curious, especially with your background in law, I'm wondering, you know, what was your response to hearing about your dad's career in law enforcement, and what kind of thoughts did you have about that, you know, with your relationship to law enforcement, I guess?
Right, because we were essentially on opposite sides of the courtroom. You know, I have, in my entire law practice, I was almost always on the defense side. And I mean, I was very briefly an assistant federal public defender for the District of Columbia. So, you know, very much defense oriented, very much about civil liberties also. And my dad, meanwhile, was, you know, law enforcement and intelligence and, you know, kind of on the prosecution side of the courtroom. My thoughts about that were very complicated, I guess, because understanding why he wound up on that path and ultimately on that side of the courtroom helped me to view that work in an empathetic way, and also understanding his intentions and his character as a person and knowing his reasons for going into law enforcement, which, I mean, he himself kind of distinguished his perspective on law enforcement from those of some of his peers. You know, that also helped me to kind of gain a greater understanding of the work that he did and why he did it. Because he actually told me that some of the folks that he worked with considered law enforcement as a calling. And he didn't look at it that way. He said, you know, I thought of it as a profession. And it's something that you need proper training to do. And by the way, I mean, it requires professionalism on your part, and it requires a certain amount of restraint and really, you know, applying the rules fairly to everybody. It's not a situation where, you know, you're called to be a police officer and you're going to be, you know, the arbiter of justice. No, he didn't see it that way at all. And so that really helped me to understand his work and ultimately his life.
I have to assume that, you know, being in such close proximity to such a traumatic incident of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, I'm wondering, you know, over the decades, has your father had time to kind of reflect on maybe like the psychological, the mental toll of bearing witness to such a tragedy that we take great pains to remember still today?
Right. We talked about that because, you know, I really don't think that, you know, until he and I started talking through and unpacking these issues, I really think he buried it, which I can completely understand because I buried a lot of this story too. But, you know, as you said, with him being in such close proximity to this horrific event in American history, and not only that, but just the death of a human being that he, you know, had tried to perform first aid on, and, you know, just a horrible instance of gun violence, which, you know, these days is just unfortunately all too common. I definitely get the sense that he was deeply traumatized by that. But because of the kind of person he is, you know, he's kind of the strong silent type, for, you know, the lack of a better phrase, I guess. He's not one to really delve into, you know, how he personally feels. And he's just not inclined to really explore how he's been hurt. But in our conversations, that definitely came out. And even if he didn't say it in so many words, just the way that he said certain things, even his tone of voice, you know, I could hear pain in his words.
And I just have to assume that this experience, it must have brought you and your dad incredibly close in ways that you would have never been able to share a relationship, I think, as father and daughter. Can you talk about that unique relationship that you were able to build over the years of collecting his life story, but also wanting to tell it with the respect and dignity that he deserves?
Well, as you mentioned, because we had this huge silence about this huge important event in his life that affected his family as well, we were never able to really become that close, you know, because we were just dancing around this huge chasm of information. And so our interactions just had this sort of cordiality to them that, and they lacked a sort of depth that one would want to have with their parent, with their father. But once we started talking, and once he was able to share with me not only what he saw and experienced around the assassination, but what led up to that and what his early life was like and how he ended up on this road to the Lorraine Motel and beyond, you know, that's when we were able to really get close. That's when I was able to understand who he really was and to be able to share that story with care. You know, that's something that's so important to me because, you know, there's a way to tell the story in a sensationalistic way that lacks empathy, that lacks understanding of the context. And that is something that I didn't want to see done. I mean, that was actually one of my prime motivators, really, was, you know, if anybody's going to tell this story, then it needs to be somebody who's going to tell it with care, somebody who's going to get it and care about the human beings who are involved in it. If we had not done this, if I had not asked that question, you know, asked those questions about what happened at the assassination and what was your life like that led up to that? And how did all this affect your life after that? If I hadn't asked those questions, then I don't think anything would have changed because how could it have? It's really one of the most important projects that I've ever embarked on, just on a personal level, on a relationship level, because now I know him and I think he knows me a lot better too, coming through this.
Yeah, absolutely. It works both ways, right? And I guess I'm wondering too, I've been kind of saving this question because I'm really curious about the answer, but I'm wondering, what's your father's thoughts on the book?
Okay, so the best way I can, you know, kind of encapsulate his thoughts are this. Ask him what he thought about it. But this was also the last question that I asked him in the last interview that we did for this book. Now, mind you, we've been interviewing from 2015 to 2022. And so, you know, we come down to the end. I've gotten down to the end of my questions, my pages and pages over the years of questions. So the last question is there anything else? You know, is there anything else that we didn't talk about or that's not covered in the manuscript that you want people to know or understand about you and your life? And he said, Lita, everything that I want people to know and understand is in that manuscript. He's very happy with the book. He's thrilled. And he's not the kind of person who's going to like emote about this overly. But even him, I mean, like he's using exclamation points from time to time. We talk about it, which he's not really the exclamation point kind of person. He's very happy. And I know that he's glad that the truth is now out there to counterbalance, hopefully, all of the lies, all of the disinformation and misinformation about him and his role on the Memphis Police Force, and that you know, people can choose what they want to believe, but now, you know, the truth is all there for those who are willing to take a look at it and engage with it.
I did want to know, what did you learn from writing this book?
Ooh, I learned so much. I mean, what did I not learn? You know, it's funny because I sent the manuscript to my mom too. And she said, that she did not know, what did she say, like 85% of what was in that manuscript, which is really funny because she was born and raised in Memphis. And she raised me, she was married to him for 5 years. And she said she did not know 85% of what was in the book. So yeah, so if she didn't know 85% of what was in the book, then I would say I probably didn't know 95% of what was in the book, if not more. But I would say that I learned about the ways in which marginalized people have to work within oppressive systems and outside of oppressive systems to try to get free, and how, no matter how they do this, how they are penalized for doing this work in various ways. Some are violence. Some are through our institutions and, you know, criminal justice system. And some of them are more insidious, including through not only what's done to you, but what's not done for you in terms of, you know, your career and, you know, hitting ceilings and things like that.
Lita McCullough-Seletsky, author of The Kneeling Man, My Father's Life as a Black Spy Who Witnessed the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., and Rabble's national politics reporter, Stephen Wenzel, in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Lita and Stephen. Switching gears now, here is Rabble editor Nick Seabrook to catch us up on the top news stories of the week in a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in national news, the hashtag #SearchTheLandfill has been trending over the past 2 weeks to pressure the Manitoba government to search a Winnipeg area landfill for the bodies of two murdered Indigenous women. Rabble's national politics reporter Scott Martin reports that the movement has increased pressure against the provincial government and it's gaining attention. Despite calls by First Nations leaders, Manitoba Premier Heather Stephenson stated the province would not conduct a search of the Prairie Green landfill. The reasons a search has been refused, according to a statement attributed to Stephenson and Manitoba Indigenous Reconciliation and Northern Relations Minister Eileen Clark, was due to factors that include health and safety concerns and complexity. Both the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs Grand Chief Kathy Merrick and Federal Crown Indigenous Relations Minister Mark Miller criticized the move, calling Stephenson's decision heartless. The issue has gained attention of many Indigenous and non-Indigenous activists and organizations across the country and beyond, including Ontario NDP leader Merritt Stiles, Federal NDP leader Jagmeet Singh, the Canadian Labour Congress, the Manitoba Federation of Labour, and the Canadian Union of Public Employees Manitoba Branch, among many others. Rabble.ca will be following this story as it develops. Staying in national politics, assistant editor Georgia Kelly wonders if Chinese Canadians may need to brace themselves for another yellow peril as right-wing media outlets continue to make baseless accusations against Canadian politicians of Chinese descent. The latest example of this is the election of Olivia Chow as mayor of Toronto. In the wake of Chow's victory, the right-wing National Post claimed that her election had been aided by so-called pro-Chinese groups. It does not seem to matter how tenuous these connections are. The Confederation of Toronto Chinese Canadian Organizations sent volunteers to help with Chow's campaign, and the Canada-Toronto-Fuking Business Association encouraged their members to vote for her, which seemed to be enough for the National Post to imply that Chow was being backed by Beijing. Chow is not the first Chinese-Canadian politician to face such discrimination. Liberal MP Han Dong, Markham Deputy Mayor Michael Chan, and Conservative MPP Vincent Kay have all faced similar accusations based on fear of the People's Republic of China. Chan, Dong, and Kay have threatened legal action against the media outlets that published accusations against them. Sitting Conservative Senator Vincent Oh has even proposed a nationwide foundation to financially assist Chinese Canadians who want to sue journalists reporting on allegations against them. Also this week, national politics reporter Stephen Wenzel outlines increasing press freedom violations against women in journalism. Data from the Coalition for Women in Journalism found that at least 12 female journalists were murdered in 2022, a pace of one reporter killed every month. During the same time period, there were 97 reported incidents of women in journalism being detained by law enforcement, with one in three arrests taking place in Iran. Since the start of this year, nearly 100 female journalists have remained incarcerated. The report from the coalition explains the chilling effect that such actions can have on women journalists, with the report reading, quote, "When women journalists are assaulted, they suffer not only emotionally and physically, but the attack or fear of being attacked can deter them from reporting entirely," end quote. And finally, according to EcoWatch, Canada's wildfire emissions had already hit a record high for annual emissions in late June, less than 6 months into the year. With over 1,100,000 square kilometers of land burned so far this year, as of July 20th, experts are calling it the worst wildfire season not just in Canadian, but North American history. 11 out of the 13 provinces and territories are reporting wildfires, and thousands of square kilometers continue to burn every day. Between Monday and Wednesday alone, 92 new wildfires were reported across the country. As of Wednesday, 4,285 fires have been reported throughout the 2023 Canadian wildfire season. Nearly 900 of them are active, and nearly two-thirds remain out of control. More than just an environmental crisis, Canada's Health Minister Jean-Yves Duclos warned that the wildfires could have a negative effect on health as well, calling the climate crisis the single biggest threat to human health. As always, you can find the full version of this story and much, much more on Rabble.ca.
Rabble.ca shares news for the rest of us. We believe News for the Rest of Us is about creating a more informed and connected world. Help Rabble.ca make quality, progressive news and views accessible to all. Become a Rabble Rouser today and support us during our summer fundraiser with a one-time or monthly donation.
That's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Do you want to share Rabble Radio on your campus, college, or community radio station? It's easy. To find out more information on how your local radio station can become a host for Rabble Radio, please email us at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.